This is KMUW, Wichita Public Radio. Engage ICT Democracy on Tap is a community engagement event series of KMUW Wichita. The following event took place on July 11th at the Anchor in Wichita, Kansas. We'll go ahead and get started here. Good evening. Thank you for coming to Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. We're really pleased to see all of you here. I'm Sarah Jane Crespo, and we'll go ahead and jump in. I'd like to thank our partners and sponsors that make Engage ICT possible for us to do every month, covering different topics about civic engagement. First and foremost, the Anchor for providing the wonderful space and the delicious appetizers. Also, our partner, the Wichita Public Library, which every month provides further reading resources on the topics that we cover at Engage ICT. And actually their guide, round of applause for the library. Their guide this time is a little bit different because our topic is so local. The guide features stories that have been done in The Eagle and from KMUW, different reporters, different very, very local names that you'll probably recognize. And if anyone would like to have a guide in digital form, we can email that to you as well if you want to write that on one of the question slips that you'd like a guide. We can send it to you because they have hyperlinks there and that would make it easier for you to read. So thanks to the library. And then also thanks to VolunteerKansas.org, which is sponsoring Engage ICT this year. So we are talking about off-year elections tonight, and that's a really important topic. It's something that kind of gets passed over a lot. A lot of people just, aren't even really aware of what's on the ballot, what's going on, when the elections are. So we want to cover all of that tonight. We have a wonderful panel here, and I'll kind of come down the row, and they'll introduce themselves and talk to you a little bit about the issue from their perspective. So the first panelist we'll start with is Dr. Neil Allen, who's with the WSU Political Science Department at Wichita State.
Hi, thank you. So first I'd like to thank KMUW for having me. KMUW is the best thing going in Wichita. And so I am in the Political Science Department at Wichita State University. And also I do election night analysis for KMUW. So that was one of the five strangest hours I've had was last November. So I study parties and elections, American politics generally, and I want to talk in general about what kind of opportunities to affect politics citizens will have available to them in terms of voting in the next couple of years around here. First, this year we have a couple of kinds of elections going on, city council elections, of which there are some that are competitive. There's even a primary coming up, which I think yesterday was the last day to register for, or today. So maybe you can do that online now.
I have forms right here for registering to vote.
And also we have school board elections, which frankly is the most the kind of race that a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to. They don't have party labels, but it's a tremendously important race. The size of the school budget is massive, and also the decisions that school boards make affect really all of our lives, even if you don't, like I do, have two kids in the Wichita Public School District, but it affects residential patterns and the kind of communities we live in. And also, sometimes school boards are launching pads for other things. Dan Glickman, who was a congressman from here for many years, was a school board member. And then recently we just elected a school board member, Lynn Rogers, to the state Senate. I don't know if it's actually necessarily the best launching pad for aspiring politician because school board members get to take some really, really hard and difficult decisions. They do not get the $90,000 you would get if you were on the county commission, for example, which is also related to the fact that we seem to have a lot of state legislators that want to become county commissioners. But also on the national level, we're going to have a chance to affect a good amount of stuff in Kansas next year. First, on the congressional level, there are four U.S. House seats here in Kansas. at least two of them look like they're going to be competitive, and possibly three. I have to leave aside the first district out in western Kansas, which might have a competitive Republican primary, particularly if Ted Hulskamp wants to try again, or Tim Hulskamp wants to try it again. But the other three districts might very well be competitive. The third in Johnson County, Wyandotte County, Kansas City area looks to be about as competitive as any district in the country. Also, the second district is open, which is Lawrence, Topeka, some Kansas City exurbs all the way down to Pittsburgh. And it looks like the Democrats are probably going to have a good candidate there in former gubernatorial candidate Paul Davis. And also here in Wichita, still on paper, the fourth district doesn't look terribly competitive. But we certainly saw a couple of months ago that it can be. And James Thompson is running again, and he's probably about as good a candidate as the Democrats are going to get in a place like this. And also, on the state level, you might have noticed that that we've gotten a lot of national attention here in Kansas because of the reversal we've had in terms of public policy in Topeka, with the reversal of tax cuts and a change to a different set of priorities, or in some ways to the pre-2012 priorities. And the elections next year will be a test of a lot of that. So we're going to have an open governor's race, which on the Republican side will feature many candidates running in a primary, some that will be strong defenders of Governor Brownback's agenda, some that will be critics, and one massively important national figure in Kris Kobach. And also, on the Democratic side, there's two candidates right now, both look viable, and there'll also be other statewide elected officials. And also, the state legislature, while only half of it's up for election, because the state senate is not up for election this cycle, the state house is, and in the state house, there'll be lots and lots of competitive elections. There'll be competitive Republican primary elections, because the moderates who beat conservatives last time will likely get challenged from the right. What conservatives survived last time, especially if they voted to sustain Brownback's veto, will likely get a moderate challenger. The Democrats picked up a few seats, not so many around here, but will likely be challenged. And so, you know, a lot of folks like to think, well, Kansas is a monolithically Republican state. You know, all we do is just pick which conservative Republican to send to Washington and send to Topeka. But that's really not true around here. And so we have a fairly, unique opportunity to basically have our ballot count in all sets of races in the next couple of years.
Thank you, Dan. Our next panelist that we have tonight is Ernestine Crable, former president of the League of Women Voters here in Kansas, and also a longtime educator in political science and history here in Wichita. Ernestine, how does this issue look from your perspective?
Well, I appreciated your talking about what's going to happen in 2018, but I want to point out to you all, it's awfully easy to skip over this election that's coming. Today is the last day for you to sign up if you're going to vote in the primary on August 1st. And you go, primary, what's on the primary? Well, there's not very much, but if you're in Wichita District 1, if LaVonta Williams is your council person, that district is going to have four candidates running to be the, it'll narrow it down to two. So they're out of the four, two will win in District 1. Now, the rest of the city council doesn't have any primary, but there's a primary in Hayesville, in Hayesville's Ward 4, and in Park City in Ward 3. Now, those three primaries are coming up August 1st. And as I mentioned a minute ago when I interrupted my dear colleague here, today is the last day to register to vote. I'm with the League of Women Voters, and one of the biggest issues that is that the League, we are nonpartisan, we're very old, we began in 1920. All of those women that chained themselves to the courthouse doors and stuff like that to get women the right to vote, once they got the right to vote, they realized they needed to educate themselves to be able to carry to vote intelligently, so they immediately switched over, and the same group of suffragettes became then the League of Women Voters in 1920. As a matter of fact, the Wichita League of Women Voters was the first league in the entire nation. And the lady that became, she became the head of the League of Women Voters Little Letters within the national suffrage movement because they said she was intelligent, attractive, and wasn't beat up like an old war horse like some of the rest were. And the first league meeting was at the Lassen Hotel on Market and First. And that happened in 1919, not 1920, because it was before the amendment had passed. But we're nonpartisan. We never support any candidate or party. We get people registered to vote, and we fight for people's rights to vote. But that doesn't mean, yeah, you can. But we study issues. We arrive at positions, so there's two parts of the League of Women Voters. I know I'm not here to talk about the League, but just there's two parts. There's one part where we help people get registered to vote. We hold candidate forums. That part is not only nonpartisan, but we don't support or oppose any issues on that side. And if you give to that side, your donation is tax deductible. Then we study issues, and then we advocate for issues. We advocate, for example, one of our biggest issues has been about funding the schools here in Kansas. We're not neutral in saying, well, whatever you want. We have studied and gee whiz, we found out that school funding was important. Deep study there. But the reason I bring this up is that the biggest issue that we've been having in the last since not even 10 years, it hasn't even been 10 years, it's just been since 2011, that in this state has been one of the leaders in a nasty way in this nation, and that is figuring out ways to repress the vote, ways to hold, to have so many loops to jump through, hoops to jump through, that people will either give up or they can't afford it. And so one of the things that we've been fighting is we've been taking those issues to court. There have been five different lawsuits that we've challenged because just as we get one barrier out of the way, for example, when it first came with the idea of showing a photo ID, they said, well, everybody has a photo ID. Well, it turns out that a lot of times poor people don't have a photo ID. Pardon? Yes, a state-issued photo ID. It was not, couldn't even be your credit card, but a state-issued photo ID. And so then they said, well, what's the problem? Well, at that time initially, guess what? It cost $18 to get a photo ID. The league pointed out, hey, that's a poll tax. If you're expecting people to pay money to get something so they can vote, that's a poll tax. And we had an amendment to the US Constitution that said that poll taxes were not allowed. But just about the time we get that plugged, then it comes that there's several others. And most of you know some of those difficulties that have been. But one of the things that I want you to watch for right now is that there is a lawsuit that is pending. We got the courts to not allow Mr. Kobach, our Secretary of State, to make there to be two-tiered voting, that if you registered with a federal form, he was going to make it so you could only vote for federal candidates. If you voted with a state form, I mean, if you registered with a state form, you could then vote the whole thing. Well, we got them to be able to say, no, they were not going to do that. The courts ruled they could. But what they've ruled is, at least through last year's election, last November's election, they weren't going to be allowed that. The Secretary of State has proposed to the legislature that they put it into law to make it so that if you register. The difference is the federal form, as we've always done all our lives, you sign at the bottom swearing under penalty of perjury that you're telling the truth. The state form, you have to have a birth certificate. Now, here's one of the catch-22s. You can't get a birth certificate without a photo ID, but you can't get a photo ID without a birth certificate. Did you get me? And if you're from out of state, it does cost, now those, the birth certificate in Kansas is free if you're using it to vote. But if you're from Texas, one of the things that, I was born in Texas, and I know to get a copy of a birth certificate is $76. Now, I've been helping a young man from Texas who lives here in Wichita, and he's just ready to give up rather than send for a $76 birth certificate. It is my hope that at some point we can get a grant from some foundation that will make it so that we can then pay for these birth certificates from someplace else. But in the meantime, we're depending on the fact that the courts have ruled that the federal form is just fine. In other words, think about it. We are innocent until someone proves us guilty. We sign this and swear that we are telling the truth. Where the other one of having to prove is saying, I assume that you are guilty. And in the United States, under President Bush, all of the attorney generals, I mean the, U.S. attorneys for each of the states were mandated to find voting problems and people that had done voter fraud or that had in the whole United States, with all 330 million people and almost 200 million registered to vote, they found 24 who had registered improperly and voted improperly. And they were looking for a period of the two terms of President George W. Bush. My main point that I want to make to you is, please don't take your vote carelessly and casually, and I assume that you're here because you don't. So then my next plea is, run for office. There are people running for these offices in August that probably never thought in their life that they would do it. You are knowledgeable. You can get yourself knowledgeable. Do it. Run for office.
So there are... Thank you, Ernestine. There are so many issues, I mean, that we could go in so many different directions with these topics, and that's why we want to keep doing Engage ICT month after month. So thank you, Ernestine, and we will continue to our next panelist, Dr. Ken Kriz, also of WSU, of the Hugo Wall School of Public Affairs.
Yep.
How does the issue of off-year elections look from your vantage point?
Well, as Sarah Jane said, I'm Ken Kriz, and now after Ernestine's great, inspiring talk, I have decided to declare my candidacy for... I couldn't get elected for dog catcher, let's face it. I come at this from a little bit different angle. I'm a professor that's with a background in economics and finance. And so one of my concerns is that people really know so little about state and local government finance, especially local government finance, and there are some really important issues out there. If your income is at or below the median income, the single largest tax that you pay, either directly or indirectly, is the property tax. Okay? Most of us don't even think about the property tax until the bill comes due, or even then, most of the time it comes through our mortgage, so we don't even think about it. But it has a huge impact on our life. Also, most of the services that we consume of government are delivered directly by local governments. Police, fire, all of the inspection type services, all of the basic service delivery that we need to have comes from local governments. And so it's incredibly important to have a strong, well-running, efficient local government. And so few people understand the parameters of local government in terms of finance. And the other aspect I come at it with my background is economic development. In case you haven't seen, the economy here is not great. It's not horrible. We aren't West Virginia with continual increases in the unemployment rate and just a spiraling downward economy. But we're also not in a position where we can say we've won the economic war yet. And so we need to be thinking about ways to stimulate the economy beyond just providing subsidies to businesses in terms of tax cuts or tax incentives. And I could go on for hours. My wife will tell you that I often do, talking about economic development policy, something we both actually study at WSU. But I think to sum it up, what we have is a problem where the only thing we really know how to do at the local level is try and cut taxes as much as possible and try and cut regulations. And so I think it's time for us to think about other ways we can look outward and, you know, make this a better place so that we can draw people in who want to be here and businesses to want to come here and do business. So with that, I'll step aside and turn it over to Damon.
Thank you, Ken. Our final panelist this evening is Damon Young, chairman of the Wichita Chamber's Political Action Committee, to kind of give the perspective from the chamber on issues of off your elections.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me, and look forward to visiting with everybody. I think that I have a couple perspectives. One is I would echo Ernestine's perspective that everyone should consider running for office, and I think that the reason is that it forces you to look at the issues that the people that you're considering replacing are actually voting on. I'm a Wichita Chamber board member, I'm on their government relations committee, and I do volunteer with the PAC. And with that, we get to interview all of the candidates that are running for office. And I find, with almost out exception, that people are motivated to run for office by issues that they will not affect when they win the office that they're seeking. Does that make sense? That they're fired up about something, whether it's coming from the right or the left, that they're very passionate about, be it via internet news or talk radio or whatever their medium is. But then when you start asking them, what specifically would you do differently? What issue are you passionate about? You get the blank stare, and you get a talking point that is a really, truly a national issue. And so for that reason, I think it's really important that everyone consider running, right? You don't just all of a sudden run. Like, you consider running. And how you consider running is by researching what people are voting on and what are they truly affecting. And I've thought about running, but I have 5 kids, ages 3 to 16. And I can't even win a majority in my own house, guys. So I know that there's no way that I could get elected. In all seriousness, the other thing I would share from my perspective is the concept of apathy, that people would say, oh, I can't truly affect change. The system's so big. Well, in my role with the PAC, I get involved in a lot of polling. And looking at how races are lining up. And you realize in these smaller races, guys, you can affect change tremendously. It's dozens of votes or hundreds of votes that these things come down to. If you think about nationally, in these types of elections, less than 15% of people turn out to vote. And then in a district, you're talking about a really small number of people who are voting. I mean, come the primary, it'll be a very small number of people that will affect what Ernestine is talking about in District 1. And so when we sit back and we say, oh, the system's so big, I can't possibly affect it, it's not true. More than ever, these local issues you can affect through researching it, through advocacy, through volunteering for a candidate. If you changed a couple dozen hearts and minds towards your candidate of choice, you actually could affect it. And then I echo everything else everyone else said about that local taxes and local systems affect us more than national ones. And so that the idea that these elections don't matter is just not true. They do. So I'll look forward to the discussion, and we'll keep going.
Thank you.
the National League of Women Voters did a research some time ago, and they found that 80% of the things that impact a person's life are in the local, are things that were laws or regulations that were passed in the local election. 20% that's left would be mostly state, with a few things federal. Everybody gets excited about the presidential election, but the truth is, what goes on in Topeka and what goes on at the city council where you live is going to have a bigger impact on your day-to-day life than what happens in Washington. Thank heaven. No, I didn't say that.
Well, that's well said, and that is exactly why we're here, because the local, what happens at the local level is so critical in our daily lives. So as we get into the discussion now, please notice that on all the tables there are little Q&A slips, question slips, and feel free to fill those out, and Haley or Zach will come around and collect them from you, and we will get as many of those questions answered as we possibly can in the course of the discussion. So now, just to kick it off, I want to kind of come to that issue itself. Is what are the things, Damon, you were talking about candidates who you run for office thinking of things that they would like to change on the national level, but right. You know, they're not on the national level. What are some things that are affected here on the local level, some hard and fast things that really affect our daily lives? And anyone can jump in there.
Do any of you have any interest in making sure that babies get enough food? Well, if you're concerned about babies getting enough food, then you ought to be interested in what goes on at the Sedgwick County Commission and the money that they may or may not be putting aside for WIC and other kinds of services. That's federal money, but they were deciding that, oh, gee, we don't think that we should have this many people getting it. If you're interested in health care, if you're interested in making sure that Zika mosquitoes are taken care of, where do you think that you're going to get the money for that? Is it going to be federal, state, or county, or city? What do you think?
County.
Although, quite frankly, there's nothing saying to the city that it can't do it. It's just that it would be more likely to say, let you do it over there at the, because there's a city-county public health department that is a joint thing. But those are the issues that matter to just the zoo. Does the zoo get funding? That was one of the big issues last year, is that they cut funding for the Sedgwick County Zoo, one of the finest in the Midwest.
How about infrastructure?
Yeah.
How about infrastructure? How many people want better roads they can drive on and want businesses to move here because they know they can get the infrastructure? How about this aspect of infrastructure that nobody around here is talking about? I can tell you because we just finished a study, which is broadband availability. Most businesses now want broadband capabilities. If they're going to move to Wichita and bring their corporate headquarters here, they're going to want a broadband connection. They're not going to come here unless they have it. How about education? Do we want to try and develop the type of workforce that, again, will be an attractor for businesses and provide the raw material to want people, young people, to want to move here, and young people who have grown up here to stay here after they leave so they can have their kids educated here? All of these things are local. I know there is some state and national influence, but everything we've talked about has been largely locally provided.
In the Eagle Today and on the interview, they're talking about developing, or they will be developing, these hikers and bees and wildlife areas, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question was about a new proposal for beach and wildlife areas and things like that. My guess is, I don't know in that particular case, I haven't followed that particular case, but typically there's some local money in form of city parks and rec or county money, and then the state may chip in if there's some kind of a statewide benefit. But again, it's primarily local. Yeah.
And I was just going to add, as soon as you filled out your question form, you can kind of hold up the slip and we can get to those questions sooner rather than later. I'll go ahead and start filtering them in so that everyone can hear. So what's the disconnect here? We have really dismal local numbers in voter turnout. What do you guys think is happening that is causing that disconnect for people?
I'll chime in on that. I think there's a certain amount of fatigue that happens. I don't know if there's, I'm sure it's been studied in journals or things that I haven't seen, but my gut is, being in the role that I've been in for, this will be my fourth election cycle, there's a tremendous amount of fatigue. When the even number election year ends, everybody just got done raising all of that money and arguing their case on either side and volunteering and getting, you know, the boots on the ground, and people they just get tired and they go, man, I gotta gear up and do this again. And it's a bit of a misnomer to think that we used our energy on something that quote unquote mattered, which of course the even number elections do matter tremendously, but the fact that we would get worn out and then not participate in the other one is sad. And I think, but I certainly there's lots of reasons, but I would throw that one in the ring, that's a reason, is that there's fatigue and burnout. And I know for my friends and family, particularly in this last election cycle when it was so contentious and the tone was so negative, it's like, can we talk about something that we can be civil about? Can we talk about something, you know, that we can really have a matter of agreement, a foundation of civility? And so the idea of even talking politics becomes like, on your list of things to do, it's not at the top.
And to piggyback on that, there's actually a concept that's starting to crop up in political science research called political hobbyism, and that's one of our problems now. And that the idea is that people think they're involved in politics, but they're really just yelling at the television screen when Fox or MSNBC is right on. And if you go back to like the understanding of politics in previous eras, like the kind of ancient Greek understanding of politics is about citizen participation that's related to the, but and even if you look at our founders, what they understood politics to be, it's about deliberating and getting active about what your common life is going to be. It isn't necessarily about being involved in the equivalent of watching SportsCenter. So if I was rich enough to have cable, I could watch ESPN and I could yell at the screen watching SportsCenter or watching my sport of choice. But that doesn't mean that I'm playing basketball. Mm-hmm. It just means that I'm watching it. And so now a lot of people understand politics, maybe if you don't realize it, as communicating with others about national issues that you hear about through media channels that really don't care much about whether you know anything or not. And so, but just think of this. Can you imagine being a talking head and going on Fox News and then, because I'll mention Fox because it's the most important these days, and then talk about local finance? I mean, I don't even think, if you gave me a minute, I might be able to try to argue that Wichita is Stalingrad because of our restrictions on businesses and things. But it just can't get into that format because people want to yell and scream about celebrities and politics. And it's fine if you want to do that. It just doesn't have really anything to do with the governments that control our lives.
I'll start out with the first question from the audience, which is directed to Ken. Wichita voters had the opportunity to vote for a sales tax to fund important services, and they voted no. What can be done to persuade voters that local taxes are important and effective? And again, everyone can weigh in, but Ken first.
So now begins the one-hour lecture. You all can just sit back and... I think there's several things, and I actually talked to some groups of public administrators about that. I don't think governments are really good in showing people the value they're getting for their money. And I don't think that's necessarily a Wichita thing or even a local government thing. I think governments at all levels are not good at showing successes. When you think about it, all you hear about is the failures. There's some kind of problem with this, or somebody wants to cut this, but there's less about the victories that are won every day with the money. And I think that's a shame, and I think it causes a type of cynicism that makes it very easy to vote things down. Now, the second thing I think in with regards to a more general type of conversation is we don't talk about public finance in ways that are particularly helpful. Okay? So how many people here think they pay too much in taxes? Okay? Okay, I'm not going to put you on the spot since you're the only person. Wow, the rest of you don't. This is a really, this is an MSNBC crowd, I guess. But oftentimes I'll ask my students that, and about half of them, maybe 60% in some classes, will raise their hands. And so I ask them how much they pay in taxes every month. No idea. No idea. They can tell you that the proposal was for $50 million or whatever it was, $70 million, I forget now. It's been a couple of years in sales taxes. But how much was that per month for most people? If you broke it down, it was, I guarantee you, a really, really small amount of sales tax that they have to that they'd have to pay. I've done some research that looks at how people perceive costs of government services. And the way we talk about cost is like if you're trying to sell a car by telling people the total cost to produce all of those types of cars in the United States. Nobody would buy your car. And so we have to think of ways that are better about communicating the true cost of government. Now, with regard to that particular initiative, I think there were some other things that were done wrong. They didn't have a particular... There's a lot of open-ended spending. Nobody wants to vote for open-ended spending. That's just not going to happen. That's like handing a blank check to a drunk person. And so that was probably not very helpful. Also, the narrative around what it was going to be used for seemed to change during the course. That also is not very good communication strategy to have that change. And so there were some general things that went wrong. There were also some particular things with that particular measure that could have been done better in my estimation.
I also want to point out that I, as a retired high school and college teacher, I have to take some of the responsibility, as do we all, because the amount of civic ignorance is really enormous. The number of people in our state legislature, in our Congress, that do not really understand. They did a research, there was a research study nationally, and they found that a general civics test, 60% was the score of most people. That was the average. I say most people, that's not correct. Was the average, 60%. Well, if you remember your school days, you know 60% was a D minus, minus, minus. But the irony is state legislators, elected officials, had scores below that on an ordinary civics test. We have gotten excited about making sure that our schools teach math and have the reading, but we've gotten away from letting the teachers teach about civics and about ways that they can get involved and understand our government. One of the issues that's, I'll just stop right there, but I do think that we've got to do, I want to tell you a brainstorm of the League of Women Voters. If we're applying for some grants and we haven't got one yet, but we want to run 3-minute or less videos at the theaters, the movie theaters, that will do like the old, I'm just a bill, I'm only a bill, da 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 da, do a little civic education while there's a captive audience in movie. And quite frankly, Bill Warren had already okayed it, and then he sold out to Phil Anschutz.
Anyone else want to weigh in there? I have another audience question here. Do any of you educate to local groups on voter rights, registrations, et cetera? She says, I work with an elderly population who are very disinterested in voting and overwhelmed. Any thoughts on different demographics?
Well, the answer to that question, and the answer, it's been the answer for the last 100 years, is the League of Women Voters. So if you call the League of Women Voters, and they'll send somebody.
That's right. We have a website. LWV Wichita, surprise.
Okay, another audience question here. Is it apples and oranges when we try to compare quality of life issues regarding inner city neighborhoods, pools closing, but are we building a large recreational beach in northwest, in the northwest of town? Should have read this a little more thoroughly. Can't read the handwriting. Do you want to respond to that part of it while I read the rest of this here?
Well, I mean, one thing we have in the city of Wichita is we have, in a lot of ways, all kinds of demographic groups, all kinds of racial and ethnic groups that are all resident in the city. In some ways, we have a microcosm of America in the Wichita. The only thing we don't have is functioning public transportation, which some places in America actually do have. But, I mean, you can look around here, we even have a kind of high-density urban living environment. But what that means is there are going to be tensions. And I understand these tensions because, for example, my wife and I moved with our children into the most suburban-y fringe of the Wichita Independent School District because it happened to be the school district that where we were interested in living in. And so Wichita is going to have these kind of tensions. And on the question of pools, I think the question was going to the idea that we have closed most of our public pools in the city.
Small schools and neighborhood services.
Yes, and we get into a kind of vicious cycle there, is that we don't have as much attendance at pools. So, for example, McAdams Pool has been the one that's got the most attention, partly because there's a racial dynamic. McAdams is in an African-American neighborhood. It was designed by one of our most prominent African-American residents, Charles Mahaffey. But also, it has all kinds of issues involved with it. One is that you've had some development decisions around the area that has moved people from that area, where it's kind of surrounded by non-residential neighborhoods. And also, you have less amenities at that particular pool, and also it's not a destination pool around the city like you do at College Hill. So less people go. Then as the attendance numbers drop, since there's a fixed cost on how much to spend to have this given thing go on, then the amount of money that we have to put into it then per use goes way up and is much higher than other pools. And so then when you have a finite number of dollars, it makes sense to possibly close. But then we have to figure out what kind of city do we want to have. Do we want to have a city that has three functioning pools and a bunch of splash pads? Or do we want to have a city that has pools everywhere else? Although, frankly, the solution to that particular problem might be a private-public partnership with us at Wichita State University and the Y on campus. Now, that might...
People have to swim.
Well, and so, but there the idea is that is a kind of a Wichita way of doing things, which is to outsource what we can't get funding and support for in the public sector to the nonprofit private sector. But frankly, though, if our city council people thought that they were going to win or lose elections based on what pools were open, then they would work a lot harder. But that's not what they understand their constituents to want.
When I moved here from Baltimore, I lived in Baltimore, a very democratic city in a very democratic state, and all they had for children in the hot weather was that they would open up the fire hydrants, their version of a splash pad. Or they would say to the kids, drive to the beach 2 hours away on the Atlantic's coast. I come to Wichita, Kansas, one of the most Republican conservative parts of the nation, and here were these absolutely gorgeous swimming pools, free for children, teaching lessons. This is a history of Wichita that has gone on for about 75 years. All right, you applauded. Now I want to ask you, how many of you were at the city council meeting this morning defending the right to keep the McAdams pool open? We had some there. The thing is,
as was just said, they will do what the people let them know they want done. If you want public pools instead of the fancy equivalent of opening a fire hydrant for people to run through, then you're going to have to let them know. If you want to have your streets not have potholes and jar your car and make you have a repair, you're going to have to let people know. If nobody ever contacts their legislator or their city commissioner or their county council or their school board, they think it's all okay. Let me tell you one interesting statistic. At the state legislature in Kansas, if they get 6 letters or communications, emails or calls on one issue, they consider it a landslide. 6. They hear from almost no one. So your voice on the phone, your emails, your letters make a difference.
Thank you. This is a really interesting question from the audience. We do have an arts and community environment here, which is a local issue, but we can't keep young graduates here without state funding for families and childhood K through 12 education, which is a state issue. What are some thoughts on how those two work together and how we can, what we can do, if anything, to kind of make them work for us?
Well, apparently the pot people think that marijuana taxes are the solution to all that. As somebody that supports public...
I'll ask that question, and that's completely off topic.
Okay, I just note that because they were waving their signs around. Although on that matter, even the Colorado example of there being more than average tax revenue, that doesn't solve your fiscal problems. Even if you could tax all the marijuana that anybody smokes in Wichita, which is probably a large number, you really don't make a dent in the fact that... Okay, well, that's what the question was.
Now, the Supreme Court has ruled that we're not funding it enough, and yet we seem to be funding other things, like LLC loopholes. Can we answer that question, please?
That's at the state legislature, and you are exactly right. Not enough. Now, this, in the last session, you know we had a whole bunch of people that let them know, and you notice it made a difference.
And many
Can I just ask a question here? I just really want to know. I thought the question was about arts and keeping people in this
school. We now have, through the efforts of a grassroots community, arts and community environment that can retain our younger people in this market. Oh. But the state is not adequately funding the education for their children.
Okay, so again, that's a state issue, and I think we're talking about the local... But hold on a second. Let me finish, please, okay? I don't think it helps to talk about, number one, the LLC exemption is now gone. That was, as of June 10th, that was gone. There is a proposal on the table at the state level to fund schools at a greater level. Now, what I will say is there, study after study have shown that having a good education system is not only a good cultural draw, but it also is a good economic development strategy, okay? And as far as the arts, at Wichita State, one of my colleagues did a study that was just published that looked at arts spending throughout the United States, found that spending on the arts is overwhelmingly one of the strongest attractor of what is called knowledge workers, people who work in the sectors of the economy that really add value and can drive the economy forward. So we have to get out of this thought process that said education is good just because, or arts are good just because. It's a good economic development strategy. It makes sense to businesses, and everybody should be able to get on board with that. And so again, I think it's all about messaging, and if we're just yelling at people that we have to fund education better, they're going to want to know why and what do they get out of it. And that's what they get out of it. And we have to be able to cite those studies and talk to people on a level that makes sense.
Please tell that to our legislature.
I'd add on that that I appreciated what was said earlier about not understanding the really big numbers that are in the newspaper and reducing them down to a per unit measurement. And speaking on behalf of the business community, I'd say that's how we think about these things, is what is the impact per family, per person, and then how do you provide value? And so when we talk about public education, which is obviously a very heated discussion, what we really want to talk about from the business community is how do we build a partnership where the graduates come out speaking the same language with the full breadth of knowledge that the arts and technical education and everything in between offers. And we don't care about what it costs. We care about what the value is that the person's able to give. And so that discussion about, I think anybody remember from your old economics textbooks the term like guns and butter? You know, the idea that you had to pick between these things that were value creators for the individual or these infrastructure raw things that you can't understand. And I think that what's happening more and more when we talk about going back to the question of quality of life is that we need to understand quality of life, that we're paying for arts. We're paying for a lot of these things on the local level. And if we can reduce it down to the, what does it cost me? $47 for this certain initiative. It might cost me $47 a year to fund a certain thing, or to cut the LLC loophole and to raise taxes $1.2 billion actually will cost a Kansas family about $550 annually. You know, I don't understand $1.2 billion. I don't know if you guys do, but I don't. But I can understand $550. So for people in the room that go, $550, I'm all in on that. Great. For the people who say, no, they have enough of my money, they should be more efficient. You can understand, you can vote on that. You can understand $550. We can't understand $1.2 billion. We don't understand it. And then I'd echo it and bring it down one more step towards the previous question about local elections. I was looking through my notes here, and you know, there's in my just from the little bit of research before this, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 community improvement districts that have three directors that will be up for election that you vote for. Like the topic of the day is local elections. So if you live in Crestview, Furley, Miles Village, Oaklawn, Peck Improvement District, Sunswept Highlands, St. Mark's, all these different districts, are you involved in those? Are you involved in your local associations? Are you involved on that local level? Because you can, back to Ernestine's point, you can advocate at city council meetings. You can advocate at county commission meetings to support your true neighborhood, you know, and hope maybe bridge the gap of that disconnect between the issues that truly affect you. So that's what I would add.
And that would give you experience so then you could run for that improvement district next time, and then you would be experienced and you could run for a city council or even a school board or county commission where you can make $90,000.
One of our audience members wants to know, how does a voter best find information to decide who to vote for, especially as to economic and business issues?
Well, I think on that, when it's a partisan election, parties give you cues on how you can vote. And this is especially true these days as the two major American political parties are taking very different positions on major issues. But there's also lots of races that are nonpartisan. And also, on the local level, sometimes Democrats and Republicans aren't terribly different from each other, although in Wichita we've had basically large fights within the Republican coalition about whether to basically fit into the broad municipal consensus that fits most American cities and counties, which is to try to find ways to attract businesses and to get money from states and federal government, and a more kind of libertarian agenda that is seemingly on the wane a little bit in Sedgwick County, but certainly has a lot of strength. But also the nice thing is, you can just ask people. Because there's people running for city council, there's people running for school board, and even things like state legislature.
they are desperate to figure out a way to do something to get elected, to try to do something that might move an individual voter, because they don't have the money to run tons of television ads, and they probably wouldn't work too well anyway, because you see an ad for Sam Smith running for something you're not even sure you're in the same district for. So you find a website, send an email or call them, and they'll, I mean, like, you know, I know my school board member, because we said we got a problem at school with our kid, and we would like to talk to you about it, and we talked to her at Panera for an hour, because that's what they want to do, because not only do they want to get elected, they want to do the job. And so politicians are just people, and their ability to keep their job is dependent upon us.
Let me add that the League of Women Voters, in the last election, we run a website called Vote411, in which we send candidates questions, and then we let them put their answers up. We don't edit their answers at all. Now, between now and November, if we can come up with another $500, we will run that vote411.org, and you can see what the candidates answer, and we will try to ask for. Now, truthfully, in Sedgwick County, we have so many people running for office, and all the way from Park City, Valley Center, Cheney, et cetera. We're not going to be able to put all of the answers for all of those candidates on our website. But yes, call them up. And quite frankly, if they don't answer you, that tells you something right there. If they're not available to you, I will tell you honestly, we had a panel of, a candidate forum, and we invited all the candidates of both parties about a year ago. And there was one candidate who did not have a public, he did not have a website, he did not have a public phone number. I had only his address. And when I finally tracked him down and I said, well, it's hard for the public to get hold of you. And this candidate said, they don't need to ask me anything. I know what I'm doing. I'm not going to tell you who it was, but
Ken, did you want to add in?
I think our
panel will remain a little bit afterward. If you'd like to come and chat with them afterward, you're certainly welcome to. Ken, what were you going to say?
I think part of the question was about finance and economic information. In terms of finance information, if it's at the city level, you should be able to go on your city website. Just go to their finance department, and they should have it there. If it's a small city, you might have to call the city. They're required to have financial reports they can provide you. Now, the problem, and again, I'll go back to this. This is a general failing. Is you're going to get a 50 to 100 page document that's going to have a lot of numbers, and you're not going to know particularly where to look. That's the problem, and I fully admit it. And we're doing a few things at WSU to try and address that. If you're thinking about the economy, there's a website called KansasEconomy.org. It's run by the Center for Economic Development and Business Research at WSU. They have a lot of economic facts and figures, not only about Kansas, but also about the Wichita metropolitan area. And so you can get some economic information there. I don't know if the Chamber site has anything. I think it does a little bit about the economy also.
Yeah, there'll be indicators on there. And, you know, groups like, I think the way I approach this issue is a little bit different. And I think you need to ask yourself, I'll just kind of look at all of you guys and say, you know, do you really want to be convinced of a perspective different than your own? You know, so how I would suggest getting educated about any issue, and I've started doing this in the last 3-4 years, is pick whatever issue it is, doesn't matter what it is, and say, I've already decided, like, I already know. Because if I want to research people that agree with me, that's not that hard. And I think that most of us truly fall into that category. We've basically made up our mind about most issues, for right or wrong, and I'm not here to judge anyone for that decision. But if you've made up your mind, finding sources of data and news to agree with you is not hard. If you're really searching and you really want to know, go through the mental exercise of educating yourself on the other side of whatever side you're on, and then thinking through, where am I coming from with this? And I think that one of the core challenges that I find in talking to people is that they really haven't, I think it was echoed, the idea that politicians are people, and that if, try this mental exercise, assume that candidates on both sides are good people, are people of integrity, are people that care about the people they represent and want to do good. If you come at it, right or left, and you say, I'm going to assume the best out of them, and then I'm going to read their positions based on that. And then you research it. And then I think you'll become more educated about what you truly believe. And I'm sad to say that I think most of us have made up our mind, and we don't really want to dig into it. But if you do want to dig into it, try a couple of those mental exercises, and I think you'll find that these are terribly complex issues, and they do require a lot of conversation. And I'd echo what was said earlier, too, about direct conversation. If somebody won't give you direct contact, that does tell you a lot.
One of the things that too many issues, this is an Ernestine Krabel editorial opinion. Too many people vote one issue, even if the person they're voting for can't have any impact. Let me give you an example. It really won't matter the person's position on abortion in the city council, because the city council isn't going to be able to do anything either side. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have an opinion and you can't still contact the state legislature and even at the federal level. But the city council isn't going to be an issue of that. On the other hand, you can check and find out if they believe that we ought to have fewer trash trucks running on our streets. And if they want to have fewer trash trucks that are destroying the seats, and they think that, and that's an issue that they could have an opinion on. So pick out an issue that is appropriate to the level at which you're voting. And if you don't know who it is, call up one of the legislators or one of the elected officials or one of the candidates and say, I'm really bent out of shape about the flight pattern that goes over my house every night at 10 o'clock. Who do I talk to about that? They'll probably tell you, in that case, the Air Force. Good luck. But the point is, don't focus and say, I'm going to vote up and down all issues on this one issue or two issues. Get yourself informed and know where the power is and what they're going to do.
So did you want to add into that? I really like this kind of theme that's coming out of this, which is to talk to the legislators and to kind of have a relationship with our elected officials. And that's
the candidates.
The candidates, and yes, of course, to kind of learn where they stand. And what I'd like to know is if this situation that we have now, where it's so rare for someone to call up whomever. Did this situation, has it been around for long? I mean, have things changed? When did it get like this? Why is it like this?
Well, I might push back against the assumption in that statement a little bit. Actually, on particular issues involving President Trump and the travel ban and various other things involving Trump, and also involving health care, actually there is a massive amount of current contacting of national government officials. And so if you notice, for example, Senator Moran had a town hall last week in Paola, which if you look on a map, that's, you know, about the site that's furthest away from population density, but not too big a hassle to drive to from the Kansas City airport. And still, it packed the hall with people that cared a lot about the issue. And there's some recent research that seems to show that on health care, people that Democrats care a lot about it, and Republicans are really not that interested in it. They've got other things they care about right now. And so, but there is I have students who were interning last semester with Washington, D.C. Office of Congressmen and Senators, and they said that all the staff said they had never had the phones ringing off the hook and more emails than they'd had in the last few months. And it does matter. And it matters because, frankly, legislators are really bad social scientists. They don't know some basic things about causal inference and math. So people that call a legislative office are not representative of the population. They're not even representative of the people that are going to vote. But politicians think that they are. And so these kind of contacts can turn around politicians. And even though Jerry Moran knows that he's going to have, what, 500, 600,000 people voting in his next election, and he's in Payola in a high school gym or wherever he was and seeing 300 people, but that experience is important for him. And so we do, and so, and, you know, even though there is polling out there, and legislators get that, although on the state level, really not as much. I mean, polling's expensive, especially good polling. And especially on issues like arts funding and stuff like that, you know, local state legislators are not going to have a lot of good polling. But, you know, all they have to work with is the interactions they have. And flooding the phone lines works. It's a big reason why we didn't get health care reform under the Clintons in 93 and 94. And if the health care bill dies in the Senate, as it looks like it's probably going to, actual individual contacts of congressmen and senators are probably going to be as important as anything that happened on the Sunday shows on Meet the Press.
I have a little bit different perspective on this because I also serve on the Wichita Pension Board. And I've served on pension boards both here and in Omaha, Nebraska, where my wife and I lived for 11 years. I've served on pension boards since the early 2000s. And what it takes for people to really get involved, most of the time, we meet every month, and we manage about $1.5 billion of city money. That's with a B. It's not a small number. And if we get into trouble, it's you who are going to have to pay the taxes in order to get us out of trouble. Now, luckily, we're not in trouble. But if we were, you guys would be on the hook. And so it's something you should all know about. In about 12 years of being on these boards, I've had one person in the community contact me in both places. And it's when they ran a newspaper story about the plan in Omaha that we were on that was in trouble, being in trouble. And so it took a crisis for people to really start to care about what had happened. And by then it was really kind of too late, I hate to say it. The die was already cast. They had to raise taxes in order to refund the pensions there. And so typically it takes a crisis for people to get involved in local issues, and that's really a sin. And that's something I think we all agree has to stop.
Well, and also pensions are a good example of some of the problems of democratic government, because public sector pensions have traditionally been a way for local governments, and thankfully apparently not this one, but certainly the state of Kansas and certainly the state of Illinois and the state of New Jersey, is a way for politicians to avoid making the kind of commitments that are going to get people to not like them. And so politicians will think, okay, in order to provide these services that my constituents demand and expect, I have to pay my workers a certain amount of money, because if I don't, they're going to go work for somebody else. Oh, but maybe I'll make pension commitments that will just saddle my future elected officials that'll be in office once I've retired with obligations that they can't pay for. And so public entities, states, school districts, cities, have been, frankly, they've been shifting compensation costs into future pension obligations, and that's all fine and good if it's 2000 and we've had the greatest bull market in history. But when we have a recession, as we always do, then it doesn't work out anymore. And some of the reason for that is because politicians figure out, well, look, I can either raise salaries for my teachers who are in my state and then raise taxes to pay for them and maybe get beat because I raise taxes, or I'll make pension obligations that look like they're correct because there's a whole bunch of math that people don't understand, but really I'm assuming the stock market's going to go up 8% every year for the next 20 years. And thankfully in Wichita we haven't done that, but you notice in the state of Kansas we did that, and then we took some hard choices to fix it, and then we had the tax cuts, and then we backed off on the hard choices, so we're going to have to do it again.
Yeah, and just to kind of piggyback on that, I think the notion of shifting our obligations into the future has been a very common thing among governments They love short-term fixes at the cost of long-term problems. Another one is infrastructure. We have so many hidden infrastructure liabilities, and there's the ones you think about, like the roads, but stuff like the sewers and the water. In Wichita right now, about 12 to 15% of all the water that's pumped out of the ground goes back into the ground before it ever hits your tap because of leaks in the system. 12 to 15%, think about that for a second. In some small towns in Kansas, it's over 20%. How does that translate to you? That's higher water bills. That's higher water bills, that's not having a good water quality because the system is broken. It's things like that, but because we don't have the money or the will to raise taxes or cut other services in order to do critical infrastructure repairs. So it's things like that. I think we've become hooked on shifting our obligations into the future in a lot of.
I want to jump in, because earlier, you remember that vote that we had? It was going to be a tax, and it was going to take care of water, and it was going to take care of roads, and it was a few other things. Well, I told you the league doesn't support or oppose any candidate, but I will tell you that the total push against that tax had its headquarters in the Koch Industries up in the Northeast. The money spent to defeat that bill came straight out of that, an opposing all taxes. However, don't want to let us off the hook. I believe there was 13% showed up at that election. That means 6.75% of the Wichita people made the decision to not repair the water, to not have jobs built that was going to help. 6.75%. Now, we have no idea if they got convinced by the money that was spent opposing it, but until we begin to show up at the polls, money is going to talk.
But also, though, this is to not to try to let the voters off the hook here, but we have a system for dealing with things like municipal finance, that if you wanted to design a system to keep people from voting, the one we have would be a pretty good solution. Because that 13%, I think I was an eligible voter, and I'm certain I didn't vote in that election because I had a couple of kids and I'm lazy. But it's not on the same, if I remember right, it wasn't on the ballot for same ballot as Congress or mayor.
No, it was on one of these like this.
The special ballots. And so like, you know, and the more serious example of this kind of thing is in Ferguson, Missouri, that a lot of us have paid a lot of attention to. And Ferguson was basically had a group of white folks that had stayed there for a long time that were basically running the city to extract resources from the African-American majority to keep funding city jobs. And they were able to do that partly because the elections for municipal offices were on their own cycle, and they were not at the places where other people vote. We vote so much in this country. We vote more than pretty much anybody else in the world does, over and over and over. And Kansas, we made a little bit of move in the positive direction. School board elections are now held at least when it's with city council elections. And when you have these off-cycle elections, it empowers whoever cares a lot about it. So it happened to be the Koch Network and Americans for Prosperity on the sales tax. That on school elections, I happen to be a backer of teachers' unions. My side lost power whenever the elections moved onto the city council calendar, because when you have elections that are off everything for school board, who do you think votes 100%? School teachers. But I'm just a big believer in the idea is that we get elections together, and also we make them partisan elections, because if there's something on the ballot for a candidate and you're not comfortable with voting for a political party, like Secretary of State, for example, or judges, then maybe we ought not to be voting on that thing.
How is it determined when something will be up for a vote?
On the federal level, we were locked into a constitutional calendar that has to do with the farm calendar of 1787, and We vote on Tuesdays partly so people could vote and then get home and not have to be traveling on the Sabbath. But on the local level, the state legislature does everything. The state legislature, I mean, Wichita is a city, the Wichita Independent School District, they only exist because the state feels like letting them exist. And so the state can do whatever they want to do. But frankly, these are the kind of things that voters don't care about too much, but determine heavily who votes and who doesn't. And as we all know, that whenever the lower the turnout gets, the more unrepresentative and frankly, white, old, educated, higher income the electorate gets. And those are people that are all voters, and my parents are citizens too, and I like them. But if you have elections that are special elections, you're going to get highly empowered people that have been involved for the last 30 years. And that's a different population than the general population.
Yeah,
and is there anybody here, and I want to do this before people leave, is there anybody here who is not registered to vote? Because I have the forms, and I have agreed. I talked to the election commissioner. I'm going to use a photocopy here and going to email it before tonight at midnight so that we make it. So if there's anybody here.
After the discussion, if anyone wants to come up and get registered, they can do that.
But the other thing I wanted to say about that is one of the things that you could do is take some of the forms or go online to get some of the federal forms and find the people in your family and in your neighborhood who are not registered to vote. Maybe you're not all that knowledgeable about issues, but the chances are you're more knowledgeable than a lot of your neighbors, and so you could be there spurring them on.
Damon?
Yeah, I just wanted to piggyback on the idea of deferring obligations to the future generations, and I think that a lot of times these issues actually start taking root long before we vote on them. And I'll give you an example. The infrastructure improvements that were put on the special election that we're talking about with the sales tax increase, right? We all remember that. There was strong views, as we stated, on both sides, really, really advocating, which I thought was awesome. And it does suck that the turnout was so low. But there was a special coalition put together of city and county folks, and they were building a comprehensive plan for 2 years prior to that. And there was lots of opportunities to go to those meetings and give input. They mailed it out to a sample population of the city and the county to get people to give input. And the turnout for those things typically is, you know, if you get above 10% turnout on these initial polls and surveys, that's considered good. So the representation of what they're deeming as important is very poor. And I'll give you another example. When I went to one of those meetings when they're working on the comp plan, probably a year and a half before the special election, and they're talking about the deteriorating sewer system, okay? So you're sitting there, and they're talking about this obligation, and I raised my hand because I'm in construction, and I said, excuse me, you know, and you feel ignorant, right? Anybody been to those meetings, you're like, who am I? What am I doing here? You raise your hand, and I said, how long have you known about this obligation? Because whenever I buy something, I understand it has maintenance, and I sometimes save money so that I'll be able to replace that thing because it has a life cycle, right? I'm a business person, and I understand things have a life cycle. I'm construction. Things last 20 to 100 years, depending on what it is you're making. And so I said, so I was sarcastic, and I said, how much money have you guys saved in your deferred maintenance fund, you know, knowing that this infrastructure had a life cycle, right? And it's city and county employees, not electeds, that look back at you with a blank stare. And then they, of course, say, we don't have any money saved. So there's an obligation that's inherent in the system that's been, you talk about the can being kicked down the road, and then they come to us and say, you need to pay for this aging infrastructure. And what I said to the people at the time was, I would gladly pay a tax to pay for that infrastructure if I knew that it would go towards it. I mean, if we put If when we created an asset and we owned it as a city or a county, and we said we know it has maintenance, we know it's going to need to be replaced, and we could actually earmark it, I think that's the joke about the whole lockbox, that we could put money somewhere and know it doesn't get touched. But it doesn't happen, you know. And like they said, who of us, we all get amnesia. We were all excited about that. And now when's the last time anybody thought about that? Probably, if you're like me, you haven't thought about it. But yet, there's that deferred maintenance just sitting there, and we don't do anything about it. But the truth of the matter is, they didn't plan for it. And in my opinion, that's ridiculous.
Well, and also that so often when people think about the idea of costs that are offloaded to the next generation, they think about the concept of debt and government debt. But I think maybe that's not the right place to put that concern, because for the debt of most of our all states, but I think one, you have to balance your budget. Now, there are ways to offload obligations, and some states can do it easier than others. Kansas, where it's harder for us to do that. But on the federal level, people think, oh, well, the problem is the federal deficit is large, the national debt is so big, there's a big clock and things. But in reality, the federal government can borrow money cheaper than anyone else in the world. We're talking about 1.5% or so. It's just, do you want to spend the money now or do you want to spend it later? And in things like schools and roads and defending us from the aliens that attack if it ever happens, I'd rather spend the money now. But where we have long-term obligations that are going to bite us is the fact that government keeps doing more things. And government doesn't stop doing things. We can see that in what happened here in Kansas with the tax cut experiment. Is that Kansas is like, yay, tax cuts, that's great. We voted for some conservative Republicans, they're going to cut taxes, we don't like taxes. And like, then the consequences are, well, we have to deal with less money in schools. And then realize, oh, well, we like the schools we had before. In general, people don't give up on their commitments and what they want government to do. So if we can just look out the window and probably start listing and spend an hour of all the things that government has done out here. There's a road out here. There's been a massive use of tax increment financing over the decades to create Old Town. More people drive down here, so we have to have more roads. We have to have more cops to make sure people don't get shot when the club gets out. And all these things, as soon as we make a decision together, we create costs forever. And it's not the politician's fault. It's our fault for not doing our work to figure out, you know, what is the cost of the obligations that we're telling them to create for us.
That's kind of brings up an interesting kind of idea, and we've sort of touched on it a little bit in the discussion, but you know, we're talking about learning what our expenses as a citizen, what do I individually pay for this government. And where is the responsibility for knowing that? I mean, should the whatever government we're talking about have a stronger marketing campaign about what, you know, who should be, are we all just individually supposed to go to all the trouble of figuring out all this stuff? Or, you know, how should that work? It used to work differently?
Just elect elect members from political parties, and when you don't like what they did, punish them by voting against them.
I would argue that KMUW and other kinds of journalists are the ones that best keep us informed, and they're the ones most likely to take it. That was how I found the information to tear it down when a young woman making $40,000 a year got all panicky about the taxes going up. And we went on to some of the local news places, and we found that, gee, it's going to cost her an extra $10 to $12 a month. And she said, oh, I can do that. So it was news and the free press that we have. And that's the sad thing, is that more and more of those sources are either going under because of finances or they're consolidating. But I say hooray for KMUW and for other sources that keep on their investigative journalism.
I agree with that. I think government does have a responsibility, though, too, to communicate in the best way possible. I don't think governments do a particularly good job of communicating their the costs of things and the trade-offs that people really have to make. And in fact, that's a major area of my research, is on how they can do that better, in order so that people really understand the trade-offs, as Damon said, for, you know, if you decide to do this, what do you have to give up? We can't do everything, and that's just a terrible, you know, reality to face. The question is, what do we want to do? What do we have to give up in order to do it? And where is the political will going to come from to form coalitions behind the types of things that all of us can agree we want to do? Yeah.
I think to build on that idea, the idea of treating the electorate like they're mature enough to make hard decisions, you know, and not a bunch of babies that just need, you know. And I think that we have to act that way, that we say, when we talk to our electeds, we don't say, do this no matter what. I mean, I've helped different candidates, and you would go talk to people and they'd say, it's like, I think was said earlier, you get one issue voters and they say, if you don't vote for this certain thing, there's no way I'll support you. And the truth of the matter is, there are trade-offs. And anyone who thinks there aren't, they're just wrong. And so to understand those and to treat ourselves in our dialogue, that we're mature people and we can understand that there's trade-offs, and then we can have real discussions.
And you can see the problem of that kind of single issue understanding in Topeka the last couple of years, because there are a lot of legislators who are elected on no new taxes ever, no raising taxes ever platforms. And that's fine, and that's a clear position that a lot of Americans support. But those legislators that actually took those pledges and stuck with them, they were not in the rooms that mattered on the budget, because the kind of numbers that the legislature was facing, the kind of obligations they had, it was going to have to be a tax increasing budget. And so, and for example, my representative is Chuck Weber, who's a Republican elected from Northeast Wichita, and he was elected on that pledge, but he was not a major player in the budget. Now, frankly, he was representing his constituents, but also, though, his constituents had given him instructions that didn't allow him to become the most effective player in the room.
Everyone, stay where you are. I do want to get through a couple more audience questions here before we wrap it up. This one wants to know the mill levy tax. How does that work? And then also, I don't know how much the mill levy tax.
I've lived here 6 years, and I still don't quite understand it. What's a mill, anyway?
A mill is $1 per thousand of assessed valuation.
Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Isn't it obvious? Okay, so the property tax. The property tax is different from all other taxes in the United States because it's not a tax really on economic activity, it's a tax on wealth. It's a tax on the wealth you have in your property. And so in order to figure out how much you need to tax, you have to figure out how much the value of the wealth is, and that's called the assessed value. So in order to get to that, what the county appraiser does is he figures out a fair value for your property. So let's say they figure out the fair value for the property is $100,000. Okay? Then in the state of Kansas, we make it even more difficult by using what's called fractional assessment. And so in some states, that $100,000 of value in your property would become the base on which your taxes would be calculated. But like I said, Kansas, we can't do anything simple. So what we do is we say, instead, we're going to apply what's called an assessment ratio of 11.5%. So now instead of $100,000 of value, you have $11,500 of value that's going to be taxed. And so residential properties are taxed at 11.5%. Commercial properties higher, it's about 20%, somewhere in there. agricultural property is actually taxed, relatively less. So once that value is figured out, then they apply what's called the mill rate. And like I said, it's $1 per $1 per $1,000 worth of assessed valuation.
The fancier house you have, the bigger house, the more value, the more taxes you're going to pay.
Yeah, the bigger land that you have. So if you compare, the bottom line is, we don't talk about that if we're comparing areas. It's how you get to what you're taxed on based on the value of your property. So in Wichita, we pay about $1.40 for every $100 of value overall. And that compares very favorably with other cities around the area. So the highest property tax in the area is paid in Des Moines, Iowa, which is about $2.65 per $100 of value. Oklahoma City, $2.61. Omaha, $2.10. Sioux Falls, $1.48. Little Rock, $1.40. And Wichita is $1.38. And so we have relatively low property taxes for the Midwest kind of upper Great Plains region. Nebraska, Omaha is $2.10, for example, which is a lot higher. And so we don't worry necessarily about the mill rate. We worry about what your taxes are compared to the value of your house.
One of the things that the director of the planning department here pointed out to us at the League when we were doing some research on this, and he pointed out that up to $200,000, it's probably very fair. But those houses that are being built around the edges of the city is going to be spending more for infrastructure building than those houses are going to be paying in taxes. Now, why is this so? It's because there's no observers coming down and watching at some of our things like the Planning Commission or the City or County Commission. If any of you want to be observers, this is another ad for the League of Women Voters. We are trying to put observers at all of our boards so that there will be people there watching, taking notes, paying attention. That's the thing, is that here, these suburban areas have more clout because of the builders that have had the influence.
Well, one thing I'd be careful about that, though, is a lot of those areas, they also have to pay special assessments. And so in a lot of the suburban areas, it's not only the base property tax, which is what I talked about, they also have to pay a certain amount over that property tax and special assessments. And that's one thing that, honestly, moving here a few years ago, we had to get used to is the whole notion of special assessments. It shifts some of the burden of paying for that infrastructure onto the richer homes, which is arguably a good thing.
So one other kind of topic that I have from the audience that I think we should cover tonight is citizens initiative petitions. Kind of talking about what those are, how those work, and I know that there's at least one coming up, the marijuana sentencing reduction petition, citizens initiative. Who can talk about what those are, how those work?
Well, one thing it's important to know is that in America we have no national referenda. So we have no mechanism in our national constitution to have national votes about anything. We can have votes about who's the best amateurish pop singer on Fox, but we can't have a national vote on anything. And frankly, I think that we probably shouldn't. And we can see in Great Britain, which is the other place I study, the catastrophe of letting citizens vote on a very, very important thing and letting politicians advocate for dumb positions, and now they're leaving the European Union, which they'll regret for the next five centuries. States and localities can, in some cases, have referenda. In some states, it's a lot easier to do that than other places. So out west in America in general, it's much easier. In California, if you have enough money or citizen interest to have people with clipboards taking signatures, you can get anything you want on the statewide ballot, and then you can change the state constitution and thus change the law of the state. Kansas is much harder. We don't have statewide citizen-initiated referendum. We do have statewide legislature-initiated referenda, which is why, since I've lived in Kansas, I have not got to vote on, for example, medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, which those are positions that I have some views on. I did, however, get to vote on the right to hunt, fish, and trap. Can't forget trap.
In the Constitution.
And so now I have that right. Although, frankly, I'm not really worried that my state legislators are going to take away my right to hunt and fish. But that's because the legislature is a gatekeeper. Now, on the local level, they're not a gatekeeper. So thus, in Wichita, we've had the ability to vote on various referenda. Although, it is a very open and difficult constitutional question as to whether we in Wichita can take a position on something we have a connection to the state with, like marijuana penalties, and take a position differently than the state does. And our state constitution is not terribly clear on this position, and our state court of appeals kind of gave us a back out by saying the signatures weren't right the last time. But it's a very complicated sort of thing. And also, if you really want citizens to have more control of politics, the way to really do it is to amend the state constitution to let us have a referendum on whatever we want. And then we can be like California and basically run the state budget through open referenda vote.
The high school teacher in me wants to explain that a referendum usually means you can vote yes or no on something that the legislature has already proposed. An initiative would be the petitions where you initiate the idea of something that you want. In Kansas, there is no initiative. You cannot initiate. So this petition that you saw a little while ago, they are trying to make it so that there is a change in sentencing for people that are arrested holding a certain amount of marijuana. It's not to legalize marijuana. It's about changing the sentencing to make it a fine as opposed to prison. But the point is, that may very well be declared unconstitutional because in this state we have no initiative right. California has the initiative right so people could get together. One of the difficulties about having the initiative is if you think about this, well, the people ought to be able to say it. But what happens is that sometimes a very well-heeled public interest or private interest group decides on a particular issue and they have some stake in it and they get out there and they fund the filling out the petitions, and that's when you get names like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck filled on it because somebody got paid for filling out a petition. But Kansas, we can vote referendum in which we can vote no or yes on something that has been passed and say no or yes that, yeah, it's going to be a private constitution that we can guaranteed forever to hunt or fish.
And trap.
Well, and trap, yes.
And the state, my understanding is that the state, you're essentially, and I'll refer to the doctors among us, that you're really, it requires two-thirds of the legislature to make it to the state ballot because you're really voting for a constitutional amendment at that point. It's to your point, it's not an initiative. You're amending the Constitution.
Yeah, which is why I, even though I'm in general supportive of hunting and fishing and trapping, I voted no on that one because while I think it's probably a fairly useless state constitutional protection, and a lot of states have it, and I don't think we really had a problem with hunting rights, but also I could imagine an argument some constitutional litigation from a hunter that, for example, wants to hunt in a state park. That amendment says that hunting, fishing, and trapping shall be the preferred method of wildlife and nature conservation in the state. Now, my guess is a court would probably see that claim that they get to go hunt in Chisholm Creek Park next to the airport and say, well, we got to have a common sense understanding of this. But I'm not certain about that because it's constitutional law. And it might not be the most efficient way to do things. But also, though, it On a related note, though, I think the best way to do this is how Nevada and Massachusetts and I think some other states do it is you can have initiative or even referenda, and you can amend your state constitution, but you got to do it twice. And in between those two times, there's got to be an election. And so to say, to figure out whether you really care or not, and also if some or well-organized interest gets something on the ballot and gets it passed when people aren't paying attention, then you got a chance to
do some organize. States do that?
Nevada and Massachusetts do. And one reason why I learned about it was Nevada, it was about marijuana. And then in Massachusetts, there was the Massachusetts same-sex marriage decision in 2004. There was a move to amend the state constitution to make it just civil unions, which was kind of a compromise position. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, the only people who cared enough about opposing same-sex marriage to do that, actually the only person was Mitt Romney, who was running for president and governor of Massachusetts, because people late thought, well, this isn't that big of a deal for us anymore. And so that's, I think, a better way, because asking citizens on one day to have well-thought-out views about a really complex issue, and you can't reverse it, that's a really hard thing to do.
Well, and they've lived their lives becoming experts on whatever their life is, and they don't have the time to become the expert on all the issues
and also might
be on the ballot.
Yeah, and also what's really nasty about the California kind of example, and this happened in Florida on issues of like green technology recently, is if you're an organized interest and you see a referendum coming you don't like, one of your moves is to get something on the ballot that looks like it's doing what they're doing, but really is protecting you. And so, for example, whenever there's any kind of gambling issue on the California ballot that's going to limit the power of the casinos, particularly the Native American casinos, then they just get something on the ballot that looks the same and try to confuse things. Mm-hmm. And so it's, to come back to where I come from, you know, I can understand Democrats, Republicans. I can understand politicians that are taking positions on issues I know about. But a referendum for better environment forever, I don't necessarily know what that means. and frankly, I'm a professional in this. If I'm not going to do the work, I don't think my fellow citizens are probably going to do it.
I want to ask a question of the audience. How many of you here would prefer that the city council elections and school board elections be partisan, Republican or Democrat or Libertarian or whatever party? Raise your hands if you think it would be better if it were partisan.
What do you mean?
Pardon?
What do you mean by that statement?
In other words, the candidates would have to declare which party they were members of.
They could. You could run as an independent, but on the ballot line.
Yeah, like when you're running for, how many of you think that would be a good idea? Okay. How many of you think that's a bad idea, that we should still say nonpartisan? Right now, it's nonpartisan. I mean, it's, you know, right.
It's nonpartisan.
But then I'll ask you a question. Carl Brewer.
It's nonpartisan on the ballot, but you probably know that.
Yeah. I was going to ask you. So Carl Brewer just a couple months ago announced that he's running for governor of Kansas as a Democrat. How many people did not know he was a Democrat before that? And frankly, though, but people can understand party, but also it becomes kind of confusing in some ways, because we have, you know, why does the county have party elections but the city doesn't? You know, they're dealing with more or less the same kind of things.
I want to ask one other issue for you to vote on. How many of you think that one way to save money? Now I'm trying to word this so it doesn't tip one way or the other. To have a joint city-county government together instead of having city government and then county government as an over. How many of you think it would be good? We have a city-county planning commission. We have city-county health department. How many of you think it would be good to have a city-county coalition government? Raise your hand if you think that's a good idea. How many of you think you ought to keep it the way it is with city and with county? That's interesting.
Did anyone come to the Engage ICT when we had the city and county government discussion?
I did. Is that the last one?
Can I say something about that? So as part of the chamber, I'm on a task force that has been helping the city and county permitting and planning process consolidate over the last about 5 years. And we've met with them quarterly for the last 5 years, and I've really got to know them. And it's interesting, remember when I said earlier about how the business community there's a perception that we want to drive cost always down in government, but the truth of the matter is we want to drive value always up. And I think the city and county consolidation of planning and permitting is a good example of that. So it's called the MABCD. It is now a metro. If you want to go get a permit for a plumbing permit or electrical or a plan review, it's done through a one-stop shop. I think it makes a lot of sense. But when I've spent time with these people and said, "What did your employee count go up or down? You know, did your budget go up or down?" The answers aren't that they cut jobs or that their budgets went down. The answer is they provided better service to the customer. And that should be what our driving focus is that it does make sense sometimes. Although there are certainly others, like rural fire, that would argue that having a rural interest on the outskirts of the county makes a lot of sense to keep them separate. So it's like a lot of issues, it's complex. But I do think there's room for it in certain instances.
Well, and there has been some research in the past about consolidation.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's done for not the right reasons. Like, I'm from Indiana originally. A man named Dick Lugar, who was my senator for many years, he narrowly won an election as a Republican for mayor of Indianapolis and then pushed through a consolidation of city and county government because the city was narrowly Democratic, but the county at the time, not anymore, was heavily Republican, so guaranteed Republicans a generation of winning election, but also left schools out of it. But some of the reasons why often consolidation increases money or increases expenditure is because cities, and this has happened in places in the Northeast, mm-hmm. where you have city municipal employees that are heavily unionized and have very high compensations. And then when you join the city and the county, then it basically means that the county firefighters and police officers get lumped into that kind of salary structure. I don't think that would happen here because our municipal unions in the city of Wichita aren't that terribly strong, and we don't pay that extremely well. And so it's not like if we consolidate that we're going to have lots of police and fire in Sedgwick who are going to have. And so in reality, the cost savings are complicated by what the question of, frankly, whether you can actually generate efficiencies or not.
Exactly, and I know a lot of the people who do this research, and what it overwhelmingly shows is exactly what both Neil and Damon have said, is that it depends on the function. It really depends on the circumstances. And so saying you should have a city-county government period or not have one is in some ways missing the point. We should always look for what is the best way to deliver services, what's the most efficient and effective way, and not do it. One of the things that we've seen in government is there are these fads that come around. And for a while, city-county consolidation was the big fad, and we all wanted to do it, and it would produce a miracle. That was the Indianapolis story. With Mayor Goldsmith was we were going to, you know, make everybody better off by consolidating. And it just didn't happen in that case. But in other cases, I think it could make some sense, as Damon said. So I think it's more about looking at what makes sense to consolidate versus a blanket solution.
So this has been a fascinating discussion. There are just so many avenues to explore here. I want to thank our panel for joining us tonight. I wanted to leave a little bit of time so that you could come up and chat with them. So we'll go ahead and pause now. Let's have a big round of applause for our panel. Our next Engage ICT Democracy on Tap event will be on August 8th. Hope you all can join us for that. It's wealth on health, kind of the impact of debt on well-being. It's going to be a really interesting topic as well. And I know that we have a few candidates for office in the audience here. Take note of that if you all would like to kind of mill around and chat with one another. You're certainly welcome to do that. And thank you very much for coming and joining us tonight. We really appreciate your time and your interest in civic engagement. Thank you all.
And men can join the League of Women Voters. LWV Wichita.
Thanks for joining us for Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. Find more podcasts and videos at engageict.org. This show was hosted at The Anchor in Wichita, Kansas. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I'm the host. For KMUW, I'm Sarah Jane Crespo.